Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, I'm Craig Parkinson, and this is the Two Shot Podcast. Pop the kettle on and let's dive in. How the devil are you? What? Two episodes in the same week, Craig. Well, it's the penultimate episode, so yeah, two episodes. And what a cracking one we had earlier this week with the comedian Joe Wilkinson. What a total delight he is. I'm so pleased you enjoyed it. Now, you know, I've always said over the years that it's all about timing, getting our guests. Well, the penultimate guest, this week's second guest, is the writer Cash Carraway. And we worked out when we were talking, I don't know if it was on or off mic, that it had been 4 years in the making through one thing and another. We just couldn't get it together, but the timing is perfect. The timing is right. And I'm so pleased she welcomed me round to her house. And this is the result. Now, I don't know if I've ever told you this, but when I'm doing research on the guests, because I don't want notes to hand, I want to make sure there's eye contact, that we're having a good conversation and, you know, we're connecting. There's no point me looking down at my notes because we're not connecting. So what I always do is I think, right, well, I've got a starting point and then hopefully that'll bounce on to other parts of the person's life or their career and we can work it out from there. And I've got little points that I can pull from the research. So the way that this episode starts is I was going to read a small passage from Cash's book. And that's where it starts. So it'll take you a bit of time to understand what's going on and then you will. So I talk about, we don't talk about her book Skin to State that much, but we kind of do at the same time. You'll get it, you'll understand. And more recently, you will have seen Cash's work on HBO in the States and BBC here in the UK. The brilliant show that she wrote, created, showran. It's called Rain Dogs. It's won lots and lots of awards all around. And it's brilliant. It stars Daisy May Cooper and the fantastic Jack Farthing, who we do speak about. If you haven't seen it, it's on BBC iPlayer and HBO Now. Do it. And Cash is nominated this year as a BAFTA breakthrough artist, which is well deserved, and we get into it. The only time she kind of shies away. We don't like compliments on this show, do we? Anyway, let's do it. This is the penultimate episode of the Two Shot Podcast, and I'm thrilled. I really am. I'm thrilled to welcome the brilliant Cash Carraway. Enjoy. I'll see you at the end. Tell me why this is the horrible version.
It's the horrible version because they changed loads of lines.
With or without your permission?
Without my permission, because they'd misunderstood what they were. So there's this one line where I'm talking about a really dark moment, actually, like feeling really suicidal. And the line is, I was between a rock and a heartbeat.
Yeah, I remember that line. Right. I remember that line because only a few days ago what I did, I didn't have time to sit down and physically reread it, even though I've read it twice, but it was a long time ago.
Twice?
So I listened to the audiobook.
Right, okay.
So it was, and I remember that line pinging out, a rock and a heartbeat, like 2 days ago.
Oh, good. Yeah. I mean, that was the idea. It was like a twist on, you know.
Yeah, and that was a very dark moment.
It's a very dark moment. And they changed it. They thought that I didn't realise that the saying was between a rock and a hard place. because that's how thick.
Oh my!
The publisher thought I was. So yeah, so it got changed. And the only time when I noticed that it had been changed is when I was doing the audio, and I was going through. I was like, I didn't. That's not what I wrote. That's not what I wrote. So yeah. And also, can I have a look?
Yeah, but I think this is. I think this is like one of the first editions, or certainly the first time it came out. That would I remember when I picked it up. Yeah.
But it's well worn, isn't it?
Yeah.
Wow, I'm honoured. It's the
I'm just here with my lovely guest, Cash Carrow. We're just talking about her memoir, Skin Estate, which I'm going to sort of go on to and say to Cash that we're not actually going to talk about it that much.
Oh, thank God.
Because, you know, I'm very well aware of, you know, people's lives and moments being reduced to poverty porn, and this is not a poverty porn podcast, and I don't want it to be. But yeah. I do want to read a couple of bits.
Oh, do you?
Would you mind if I did?
Well, yeah, I mean, yeah, sure, if you want to see me cringe.
Well, no, it's not. It's kind of important, I think. But I don't think there'll be the bits that you're expecting, and I think it's quite a good intro.
Yeah, I do, yeah,
for,
sure.
For people listening who won't have read it.
Well, what I was saying, the reason I was saying it's the horrible version is because I didn't write a poverty porn book.
No, you didn't.
The original, well, I mean, I feel like this, I feel like it became one. Like the original manuscript was very much a sort of celebration of the gutter. It was fun. Mm. And it was really quite different to the final manuscript that ended up in here, because I was sort of forced to put all this stuff about politics in there.
Yeah.
I didn't really know about it. So there's these extra 20,000 words that don't need to be there, which is just me going, oh, I hate the Tories. Oh, I really hate the Tories. And without that, the actual manuscript is really quite beautiful. And it's a real, they thought it was too, it was like glamorising poverty. So they were like, we can't actually sell this book unless we make it possible for people to learn from it.
And also have some sort of political angle.
Yeah, and I was like, oh, I don't know anything about politics. And they were like, well, you know, who do you vote for? And I'm like, well, you know, at this point in time, Labour. If there was an election, I would vote Labour. And they're like, oh, say that. And it just, they basically added on to the end of every sentence, or made me add on to the end of every sentence, oh, but I bloody hate the Tories. And it just becomes really repetitive and takes away all the art from it. And then also on this edition, this hardback edition, the blurb just makes me sound really pathetic. Like it takes away any kind of autonomy of me writing the book. You wouldn't think I'd written the book. You'd think that someone had written a book about me. And I said, there was a lot, I can't find it here, but it was... It said something like, Cash Carraway lives in temporary accommodation. She's a single mum. She's been, what was the line? It was something awful. She's been trapped in the system since she was 16. And I was like, this is not true.
Yeah.
Like, first of all, I wasn't living in temporary accommodation when the book was released. I was living in a council flat. And also, look, what does it even mean, trapped in the system since she was 16? I was like, well, that's not a thing. Like, when you're 16, you're a grown adult. Like, it makes it sound like I was in care. And it was just really weird. Like, I said, oh, well, that's what we're going to do. We're going to put it out like that. That's how we're going to sell books. And I was like, this is, you know, it's wrong.
Well, exactly. You hit the nail on the head there. That's how we're going to sell books.
Yes.
Because that's their angle.
Yes, exactly. And so whenever I see someone hold a copy, this hardback copy, I always just feel like, oh.
Oh, no, I feel we've started. I've brought a storm cloud into the
No, you haven't
home.
At all, because it's such a thing from the past. Like,
yeah.
Like, I have really mixed feelings towards the book, because I feel like it was really misrepresented.
Right.
Plus, I was investigated for literary fraud by The Guardian,
yeah.
which was really fucking scary. But it also changed my life in such a great way, because it was my foot in the door to television, which is, I'd been trying and trying to get a TV show off the ground for 20 years.
Yeah.
And I know Skin Estate didn't get made in the end, but it was my route in. It was my way to do it. So, you know.
And we all need a route in.
Well, yes,
maybe,
it wasn't ideal.
Maybe I shouldn't read from it.
What bits are you going to read?
Well, it was something that I thought was very important, which was just the author's note.
Mm. Because that's authentic to me. That's it. They didn't change that.
Well,
that's
the thing is, I hope, and you can tell me if I'm wrong, tell me if I have picked the the authenticity here, which was the author's note at the start.
Mm.
And then it was the last sort of three paragraphs of...
Okay, that's interesting.
Of the book, which doesn't really, I don't think...
See, that is authentic.
Mm.
But it wasn't in the original manuscript, and it wasn't a sort of message that I was trying to put out there. It was the editor had said, oh, you sort of need to sum up how you feel. So, you know, and that's what editors do, isn't it? They throw a suggestion your way, and sometimes it's right, sometimes it's wrong. Personally, I didn't want the last line of my book. The first line of the book is namaste, smeared in shit.
Mm.
And I think that's a quite bold, exciting opening for a book. And for the final line to be, imagine if we all spoke up together, for me sounds a little bit weak. And if it sort of feels like what I was, the sort of position I was forced into, which was they want an activist. And I don't see myself as an activist, never see myself as an activist, but they wanted this mouthy activist who was speaking up for women in poverty. However, I do think it was real what I felt, what I wrote. And I do believe in what I said there.
Yeah.
But for me, it's just not the dynamic end to the book that I wanted to write.
Well, the joy about this podcast is we can chop and change as we go. We will not...
Oh, no, but you can. I don't
know. I just thought it was really important because it didn't signal any of your worries throughout the book of it turning into poverty porn at all.
And oh, that's
good.
It
was more however you speak, we've all got a voice. And I think...
And I do believe in that.
Well, I know. That's why I believe in it. And I think it's something that has come up on this podcast over the 6 years.
Right.
About solidarity and having a voice and asking questions.
Yes.
Are very, very important.
Yeah.
But maybe we'll leave that till the end.
Whatever you want. Yeah, it's your podcast.
Or maybe... No. Because it's not about me. It's about you, Cass. Today it's our podcast. I'm just going to have a nice drink of my tea.
I hope it's not too strong.
No, it's perfect, actually. So, Cash, tell me, how do you feel about podcasts? Do you listen to them?
Yeah, I do, actually, yeah. I love Adam Buxton's podcast.
Yeah. Why do you pick Adam's in particular? Is it because you get to learn more about the person?
Yeah, and I feel sort of invested in Adam Buxton because I've been a fan of his since I was a teenager.
Mm.
So I feel like I've gone on this journey with him, I suppose. That's probably the only podcast I'll listen to where I don't necessarily have to know of or particularly like the guest. I'll just listen to it consistently, you know, when I'm in the gym. But there's others I sort of dabble in and out of. I listen to some.
Because there's a lot out there.
There's a lot, yeah.
Can I just ask, is your little purple light on there?
Yeah.
That's good.
Oh, good.
I'm just double checking.
I'll keep an eye.
It's one thing, when I don't have my producer with me, it's one thing I always don't double check.
Yeah.
If I don't do that, then we're not recording.
Okay, I'll keep an eye on it for you.
It's fine, don't worry.
But are you, I know you've done an interview about ending the podcast, but do you feel... that you were giving something to the podcast world, or because you said it was like saturated, do you feel that it was you'd had your time?
I think so. I mean, I suppose not that this is about me. You're very good at turning it around. That was good. But
it's a conversation, no?
It is a conversation, exactly. You hit the nail on the head. But I suppose it's about not having any expectations, because I've always said, you know, oh well, I don't really know what I'm doing yet. Mm. So if you're willing to come on the sort of learning journey, maybe we can do it together. And if one person listens, that's great.
Yeah.
But what I've got out of it, I mean, the things that I've got out of it are so long I couldn't even begin to start.
Mm.
But there's a richness in human connection and learning and listening to people's stories and there's a great skill, I think. I'm not saying I have a great skill, but there is a great skill of never having met somebody before, never having spoken to somebody before, and all of a sudden you hit record and you're just talking with somebody.
Yes.
It's not stilted, it's a flowing conversation. I know people who have been in my life for many a year who can't have a rally of conversation and they've known each other for a long, long time because they're not inquisitive.
Well, they know too much about each other already. There's no more questions to ask.
Well, possibly, but there's always questions to ask. There's always, how are you?
Yeah.
how's things? How's work?
How are you? How are you?
Yeah. How am I?
Yeah.
Pretty good.
Good.
Pretty good. I was talking to you before. It's not that I don't like Christmas. It's that I feel an internal sense of anxiety around Christmas, the pressure of the end of the year, and also, and I'm going to sound like some sort of curmudgeon here, but I'm not. I'm quite a nice, happy man. But forced jollity, I find quite difficult.
Yeah. You know? Yeah, I find it difficult just because the end of the year, if you haven't achieved everything that you would have hoped to have achieved, you feel there's a lot of pressure and there is the pressure to be happy. And you know, I used to find Christmas like awful. Used to absolutely hate it. Only in the last, my daughter's nearly, she'll be 14 next year. Like the last 14 years, I found it like nice.
Yeah.
Because there's a reason to celebrate it.
And also I feel sometimes, because my son's 12, that the pressure's on in a certain way, but it's off in another way because the spotlight turns onto them. It's about them, isn't it?
Absolutely, yeah.
So I do like that aspect.
So you're excited about Christmas?
I'm excited about Christmas this year.
Good.
Yeah.
Good.
It's difficult with broken families, I suppose.
Yeah,
you know, I did say this to you before, but you put the radio on, all the adverts are about all families coming together and having the greatest time. But, you know, I want to hear an advert or see an advert on the telly where it's great for about an hour and somebody's really getting on your wick and you need to go to the other room and just scoff them in
the eye. Which is the truth of it,
which
isn't
is
it?
The truth of it. And calm down and go, I can't believe Auntie so-and-so is going to pop round in a minute.
Well, real families hate each other, don't they? That's the truth of it.
Yeah.
And so you were talking about podcasts. Like, what podcast do you listen to and what sort of inspired, like, this one?
I think what inspired this one is, I think, terrible journalism.
Oh, God, there's a lot of that.
There's a lot of that. And also people that don't listen.
Right.
Because as an actor, you know, that's 90% of our job is to listen. We have to be very, very good listeners to be in the moment, which is the spark of having a great conversation is because you're listening. And I found that the long-form interview conversations that I was hearing on a podcast is very, very different with radio, isn't it? Because you know they've got a 7-minute window, they've got a 12-minute window, something like that, and they're there to do a job. They're there to sell a TV show or a film or a book or whatever, and that's what they have to try and get across. I was excited to not have surface-level conversations like what you have on a set, which you kind of have to because it's like you sit down, you get a cup of tea, right, the Sparks have done their job, you're back on set, it looks brilliant, it's time for you to do your job. So I just thought to not talk about acting with actors is a good entry point for me because it's kind of what I know.
Yes.
And then I can move on to poets and musicians and writers.
Yeah,
and
all sorts of
creative people to see how that.
And I'm always interested in hearing about someone's like creative process, not necessarily like the intricacies of it, but just sort of the struggles that they come across along the way, and to hear that someone doesn't find something easy is always really interesting to hear. But you said something about journalists and how there's bad journalism out there. Like, you know, we know that. Like, have you ever been like misquoted?
Not that it's had any effect that I've been really bothered about it. But I know some people in my game that it has, and it's they feel that they came across in a very, very different way to what they were in the room with the journalist. But then again, you know, I've had great interviews. I know some fantastic people that interview people, but I also know people that have, as you know, we're just here looking at each other, having a cup of tea, and hopefully soon to be scoffing a donut. but they have a list of questions. And they spend a lot of time just with the head down, with zero eye connection, going through the questions that you've already been asked by another journalist 20 minutes ago, and you know full well they haven't really watched it.
No. Oh, no. Or they've watched, like, half an episode whilst playing around their phone.
They've read a synopsis. They know who's in it.
Oh, yes, that annoys, yes.
And all they want to do is talk about the job that you did before that. Really.
Yes, or their opinion of you. Which is a false opinion that's come from something that another journalist misquoted you with, and the cycle just keeps on going on.
Lazy. journalism, really, because they're just nicking it off other people. But also what's started to happen, just connecting it with podcasts, I don't know if you've been aware of this, that somebody will say something, I mean, hopefully interesting or controversial on a podcast, and then a paper nicks that story.
Yeah.
And
takes away all context.
Takes away all context and then go, we've heard that this, and then they don't quote the source.
Do they call you for a quote ever?
No, they just listen to things like this.
Right.
And then nick it. And that's really, well, apart from being unethical, it's completely unprofessional.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. And rude to the art of the podcast as well, because obviously you've done this long form interview. You've taken the time to get to know someone in the hour that you spend with them.
But maybe they don't see it as an art form or have any sort of journalistic.
Yeah, I think actually merit. The problem I find with journalists, is this going to be like a whole podcast slagging off journalists? It
could well be, maybe. Who knows? This is just our opinion.
Is that they'll just like, they take everything so literally, and there's never any sort of art or humour taken behind it. And I think especially for working class writers and actors, everything always sounds so bloody twee and pathetic, because they've taken, you might say something really funny about, you know, made a really dark joke about abuse or something, about being something tragic that happened to you in the past, and you'll say it in a funny way and it will be boiled down to this really sad sentence.
But again, we were talking about angles before with the book.
Yeah.
That's their angle, especially if we're looking at working class actors or writers or anybody in, a middle to upper class world.
Mm.
They want to go with that angle of, well, they were brought up in a gutter.
Isn't it so difficult,
but look at them now.
Yeah. I know. That's a very strange thing.
So tell me, when we were talking about the book at the start, we were talking about 20 years of treatments and ideas that first started. What sort of piqued your interest at the very start, if we can go right back, of just putting pen to paper or opening up that laptop? Why did you feel stories need to be told?
I think, like, it was, for me, it was something, it's not a very interesting answer, unfortunately, but it was something that's was very instinctive. I spent, my childhood was very strange.
Mm.
And for the first like 6 or 7 years of my life, I was in hospital a lot because I had like childhood arthritis.
Which I had never, I mean, it was obviously, it might be my lack of knowledge, but I'd never heard of that until I read it in the book.
Yeah, it's quite a rare, it's well, I don't know, is it rare? I don't know, it's an autoimmune illness. And I was really, really quite ill with it. And I felt like I was always sort of observing from a hospital bed. And because I couldn't walk properly, like, or, you know, sat in a pram, or, you know, as a, you know, the 6-year-old sat in a pram, that's quite weird. So you're sort of looking at the world in a different way. And you know, I come from a Irish family. And, yeah, we are working class. But the thing with the Irish is that there's always stories being told. Sorry, am I doing
I'm just moving that mic a bit closer, that's all.
There's always, you know, folklore, stories being told. And I guess this is going to, I mean, this, everything has always come for me from a very dark place. And I don't mean a traumatic place. I mean, like, finding interest in dark things.
Yeah.
And I remember the first time I ever really got, like, a laugh for something I'd written. It's always when you make someone laugh, isn't it? That sort of, you know, sparks it up.
But I think it's one of the hardest things to do.
Yeah.
That's why I think, I always say, I was having an interview with somebody the other day and they said, oh, what would you like to do next? And I said, well, I'm always so excited whenever something drops into my email that I've never read before. That's really exciting.
Yeah, like, of course.
You just don't know.
Yeah, yeah.
But I believe, apart from comedy, which is like my first love, which I think is very, very difficult to get right, I think the romantic comedy genre is really hard.
Yeah.
It's so hard.
Yeah.
And when you see something that is truthful and funny and romantic.
Yes. Yeah.
On to a winner, but to get something like that, to get all those elements there,
yeah,
it's very, very difficult.
What's your favourite rom-com?
God, that's again, it's really, really difficult.
Yeah.
I mean, everybody's going to go back and say When Harry Met Sally, because it is...
It's a classic.
It's kind of a classic for a reason.
Mm.
And the talking heads, cutaways of the real-life couples is really nice, because then we get that human connection.
Yeah.
And it is genuinely funny, and it's genuinely romantic.
Yeah, yeah. So that would be yours?
I think so, off the top of my head, yeah. But I'd love to see a modern-day classic be, you know, there. I mean, obviously... They're classic for a reason, but something on telly now or on the cinema. Did you see, I tell you what I found, not that it was a romantic comedy, but something that I found deeply moving last year was a film called Past Lives.
Oh, do you know, it's on my list.
Please watch it.
Right, okay. I'd heard it's like, you'll be bawling by the end. It's like...
Yeah, I've seen it twice and it had a real guttural effect.
Right, okay.
I really, really enjoyed it. And the fact that it was first-time female director, everybody in it was astonishing.
Wow.
There wasn't a wasted beat.
Oh, that's always clever. That's always good.
It didn't go on too much. It wasn't saccharine in any way. I mean, I'm not going to say too much, but I highly recommend it. I highly recommend that for anybody listening as well, like, over the Christmas period.
Well, I should check it out, definitely. My favourite rom-com is Taxi Driver.
I mean, okay, let's, when do
I mean, I'm sort of playing, but
no, but I think you're being serious as well.
I mean, the lengths that Travis goes to for a woman, it's unreal.
Rom-coms, like, okay, being a mentally unstable...
The porn cinema, what a wonderful date.
I mean, we've all been on great dates.
It's memorable, you know. He's a man who makes things memorable.
Yeah.
So, that's...
When did you first see Taxi Driver? You weren't old enough to watch Taxi
To watch
Driver.
It when it first came out? No. I think it must have been when I was at film school, like maybe in my late teens, early 20s.
Oh, right, okay, so you were old enough. Kind of.
That's when it first came out, I think it came out in like 76.
Oh, no. How old were you when you first saw it?
Well, no. That's
fine. Yeah, it was 76 when it came out.
Yeah.
The year that I was born.
Oh,
so I remember a lot of great films came out in 76.
What else came out in 76?
I think Jaws came out in 77. I might be wrong. Someone Googling now, shouting. No, it wasn't. But I think it was around that time.
Right. Peaked at sea level. You can't beat 70s movies. I'm a big fan of Paul Schrader.
Yeah.
And you can't make films like that anymore, I feel. Like, there's...
Do you think people try to?
I think the only people that kind of get close to making those something that feels like that, and it is different, but something that feels like that are the Safdie brothers. Like, I feel they edge towards that kind of world. Have you seen Daddy Long Legs?
No.
It's a Safdie brothers film. It's like one of their
earlier
films, yeah. And it's actually one of the inspirations for Rain Dogs, actually.
Was it?
Yeah, in terms of just the style and the sort of chaos of it, that was sort of like a touchstone for me.
Well, the chaos was captured.
Yeah.
So you spoke before about the certain elements of Skin Estate now that you look back on and you weren't happy with at the time. But with Rain Dogs, obviously... You have complete control over that.
Yeah.
How did you get the foot in the door? How did that start?
So the foot in the door is a mad, mad story. So the book was dead. The book was completely dead because the Guardian did this investigation and I just went into hiding. I was just like, this is...
Do you mind just explaining about what that investigation was? Because I remember... have to go totally into this. I know it was deeply upsetting.
It was scary. And actually, looking at it in hindsight, it's kind of exciting. Because how many people do you know who've been investigated for literary fraud? Like...
Two.
Who's the other?
No.
Who are they?
I don't know them, but... And we can always edit this out if I'm incorrect. Do you remember a book years ago. I think it was called like, was it called A Million Little Pieces?
Oh, James Fry.
Mm.
Yeah, yes.
I believe that he was investigated.
He actually, I think, I'll edit this out if I'm
kind
of liable here, but I'm of the belief that it was proven to be false. And in fact, I do have a copy. I think it says in the front that it's this is a work of fiction.
Right.
And I think they amended it to become a work of fiction. I'll dig it out and listen. Mm. But me and James Fry. But I actually was telling the truth.
Yeah, well, we know that now.
We know that now, but no one knew at the time. It was a really, it was odd because, so I guess I'd have to rewind a little bit. I did a play called Refuge Woman, which was a satire. It was, I billed it as like live poverty porn, and it was actually, talking about journalists, was about the way that journalists take a trauma story and sort of misquote and misuse the woman who they've normally taken that trauma story for, and then present them to the world as a victim. And I'd done this. Oh, God, I'm actually shaking talking about it because I had never spoken about it.
Is it because you're thinking about it as well?
Yeah, because I'm just thinking about how horrible that time was. Like, I was just this, like, playwright that no one had heard of. Like, doing, you know, I'd got some Arts Council funding. I got funding from, I think, University of Portland. You know what it's like when you're putting on shows on the fringe?
Yeah.
Like, you're starring them yourself because you can't afford the actors.
Yeah.
You get a cheap venue. And, you know, I had, like, funding from Battersea Arts Centre and Camden People's Theatre. And, man, this is small. We're talking, like, 50-seater.
I used to live near Camden People's Theatre. Yeah, you know, I've seen things like it's their tiny little spaces.
Yeah, yeah, that no one goes to. And you're lucky, you know, you're lucky to fill the space out because no one really hears of it. And it's quite experimental. And that's the realm that I was working in. And I was just, you know, I'd written this play and we'd got some fun. And I had to do, like, I'm going to use a horrible word that's going to make both of us cringe. Immersive.
Oh.
But you have to do these things to get the funding.
Yeah.
And so me and the director, Conrad Murray, we were like, well, you know, we can't afford to do videos. We'll, like, do social media. We do videos there. So I was doing these videos on social media to promote the play. And suddenly I had 20,000 followers who thought that the play was me.
Right, okay.
And they go, someone said, oh, that's not her real life. She's playing a character. I'm like, yeah, I am playing a character. And they're like, well, she's a liar. And it came from that.
No way.
And then suddenly there was all this stuff all over, like, message boards. Cash Carraway's not a real person. She's a character, blah, blah, blah. And I was just like, what? This is like, and then suddenly all the shows were selling out.
And okay, so that's a double-edged sword.
Well, I mean, that was fine. But then someone had bought all the tickets to a performance. There was no one there.
No way!
Yeah, it was just really odd. All these really mad things kept happening. And it was around this, and I had the book deal for Skin Estate at that time.
Right, okay.
And then someone was, like, writing to the publisher saying, she's a liar in this play. How could you trust her to write a book? And I'm like, but it's a character. It's like, I don't, like, it's not me. I'm not going on stage and doing a speech about my life. Like, it's an actual play.
Yeah.
And, but it turns out that the person who was behind sort of all of that was an author. And I use the word author with inverted commas.
Yeah.
Who was signed to the same publisher as me.
Holy fuck.
And the publisher were aware of it. And I kept on saying, why are you letting this woman do it? But she was sold a lot of books for them. So they were like, oh, just shut up, you know, or we'll take your deal away. Like, it was horrible.
You see, at that moment, and I don't know the publishing world at all, but where do you turn to there? Who do you trust? Because you would think that people on your side would be the publishers.
Yeah, no, they weren't. They were, you know, this was a best-selling author who was behind all of this. But they were the first person who wrote Cash Carraway as a liar online.
Oh, my God.
They were later exposed as, like, a big racist and all that kind of stuff. So, you know, I felt quite vindicated at the end of that. But this is the first time I've ever spoken about her. I've never met her. But she basically got the wrong end of the stick about this play that I had put out there and tried to destroy my book deal with it. So because of all that stuff that was online, that was where the Guardian investigation started from.
It just goes to show how that a sentence can just catch fire like that, especially when she got the completely wrong end of the stick.
Yeah, and I kept saying as well, and publicly I'd keep on saying, I was like, your play is a lie. And it's like, because it's a play.
It's a work of fiction,
And it's and I kept saying, it's a work, it's a piece of art. And they're like, Cash Curry thinks she's an artist. And it was like, okay, well, you might think it's shit art, but it's still art.
Yeah.
Like, allow me to say that. But, and it was just, I was just sort of mocked upon, like, over these, like, message boards and stuff. And, like, when I think of it now, I think it's great. Like, I think it's amazing that this little play that no one actually saw, none of the people that wrote about it actually saw it.
Oh, but they've got an opinion.
Oh, they have.
Oh, they've got big opinions. Yeah, yeah. It's always those people.
But also, they didn't know what it was about. They kept saying that it was about, and this sort of isn't entirely their fault, because a journalist had put wrong information out there, saying that it was about my time spent in a refuge. And, you know, they hadn't seen it either, obviously, because it wasn't about my time spent in a refuge. You know, the character... So you know the way, I wanted to really capture the way that when working class people tell a story, it's always like really embellished and hyperbolic. Like, because I was really obsessed with those magazines like Take a Break, Chat Magazine, where you'll have like a ridiculous headline, which it will be, I don't know, my husband chopped off my arm with an axe before running off with his mother. Like, so really ridiculous. And it was, and this character keeps, as the play goes along, the headlines around her become more and more ridiculous.
Right.
So, you know, it starts off like really simple, really normal. This is a story about a time I lived in a refuge. And then it's like, then she's lived in 16 refuges and it's become big and it's, you know, it's this whole thing. So it was about the way that working class people's lives are made bigger and faker than what they are. And then... Yeah, then it became that. Like, it actually became real. Like, this, like, the embellishments that I'd said on stage became fact in the real world.
Isn't that nutty?
I think it's great.
Yeah, I mean, it's incredible. Did you feel that at the time, having to go on stage every night when all this was going on? Well, did you feel it was incredible?
I felt a bit scared because I hadn't been used to any kind of attention. And I sort of realised that, to be famous would be awful. To have any kind of fame would be a terrible thing. Mm. And I felt scared because I was getting a lot of abuse. But it was quite electrifying in the theatre, because also what was interesting is that you had half the audience, because like Refuge Woman was a character that I'd been developing for about 3 years before this show. And I'd go to... I love Andy Kaufman. And I used to take this character, Refuge Woman, to comedy clubs. And me and my friend thought it'd be really funny to take trauma stories and just say them as real in a comedy club. So that's what I was doing with this refuge drumming character.
Yeah.
But people had got sort of over the years and sort of got to know that that was part of the act type thing. So half the audience were in on the joke. When these shows were selling out, half the audience were in on it. And the other half were just like, oh, this is just so sad. This is awful. She's so brave on stage. But they couldn't understand that people were laughing. And they'd be like, and I'd be saying things, like outrageous things, like really ridiculous things. And they'd be like, oh, sorry.
No, it's all right.
They'd be like, oh, thank you for sharing your story.
Oh, poor you.
Yeah.
Oh, God.
And it was, so I was finally really interested. Conrad was loving it, the director, because he was just like, I've never seen anything like this. This is wild. And yeah. It all came from this sort of satire that people read as true. And I think the problem is when a working class person tells a story, especially if it's dramatic, that's something I've always played with throughout, all the unseen work that went on for like 20 years before Rain Dogs came out, was playing with the perception of when someone tells a sad story, how is it treated? And if you're working class, it's treated like you're a bit pathetic.
Yeah. Were you seeing that reflected in certain art forms, like on the telly and
yeah,
the radio.
I think I must be. I think it must have been around the time where Jeremy Carl was huge, and around the time someone killed themselves on Jeremy Carl gets killed themselves after.
That's right. Yeah.
And I think I was just obsessed with that. And also, I do have a chip on my shoulder, and you know, people act like it's a bad thing, you know, because people with chips on their shoulders are normally quite angry and
yeah.
bitter. And I don't feel like that, but I do feel sort of. I notice sometimes when I'm treated differently because of my accent or because someone views me in a certain way. Like, so for example, like in England or in the UK, I'm viewed as a working class woman who wrote a book about being poor. Whereas in America, I'm viewed as a serious showrunner of a HBO show.
Yeah.
Which is really interesting to me, you know?
And are the differences significant in how you're treated?
Yeah, because yeah. I'll take a meeting over here, and this is happening less and less now because I think like some of the excitement that happened over in America sort of found its way over here. But I would go into meetings and they'd be like, oh gosh, now wouldn't you just love to make a show about the struggle of the working class? I bet you'd really like that, wouldn't you? And it's like, no, I want to, you know, I want to make sound like a Scorsese film.
I want to make everything.
Yeah, yeah. And you know, they're like, oh, I bet you're interested in telling working class stories. And it's like, I am interested in telling interesting stories. And a lot of those stories tend to be working class because I spent my life around interesting working class people. So, yeah, I do want to tell workers, but to go to a meeting and have someone really condescending towards you, and that's, yeah, that I did, yeah, I did notice that. That was something that happens, and, you know, happens now and again, even now. So
I think it just does. I remember, going back a fair few years now, was sent a script, and it's all set in the northwest of England, which I do get sent quite a lot, because, you know, there's incredible stories
and great writers from the northwest
of England. These writers were not from the northwest of England, but they'd set their series in the northwest of England, which is absolutely fine.
But for funding purposes,
I don't know.
Right,
I don't know. but it had been greenlit,
right?
And it was just reading the words on these pages. It was quite clear that these two fellas from Oxford had never been to the northwest of England,
right?
Okay. But which is really odd, and it's like, well, I don't totally stand by with write what you know.
No, I don't.
I don't. Yeah, I do think I agree. It's a bit bullshit, but at least do a bit more research if you're gonna
immerse yourself in the world that you're writing about.
I remember I worked with Martin McDonagh a few years ago.
Did you?
Yeah,
in a play.
Yeah,
what play was it?
It's called Hangman.
Whoa.
I haven't been on stage for since my son was born.
Okay. Where was that? Was it the Royal Court?
Wyndham's.
Oh, whoa.
Yeah, it was when I was out of the country when it was first cast, and then it was moving to the West End.
Right.
And will you come and meet? And met Martin and Matthew Dunster there. And Matthew Dunster's very...
Hang on, is this the most recent production?
It was about 6 years ago now, I think.
Okay.
Yeah.
Right, okay. Matthew can't believe I missed that.
Oh, you would have liked it.
Yeah, yeah.
You would have really liked it. And Matthew Dunster's, the director's very staunch flyer of the working class northern flag, because he's from Oldham and he's very much like that. But he wants, you know, really strives for theatre to be accessible for everybody, and wants to go, right, I need to get these children that have never heard about Harold Pinter to come and see a Pinter play, because I think it's really important. How am I going to do that? Well, if we get this person who's got the chops, they know that person and they can come in, and it's just opening the door.
Yeah.
I'm going off-piste a little bit. But when I was talking, because the whole play was all set in a pub in Oldham.
Right.
And it was like many pubs that I've been to in the northwest of England, it was pretty much exactly like it. And certainly with obviously heightened theatrical characters in there. But characters I've met over the years, whether they be in Oldham or Manchester or Blackpool, where I'm from, you know, there were some characters in there that, excuse me, reminded me of characters of a pub near where my grandma and granddad used to be in Blackpool. So I said to Martin, how long did you sort of spend up in Oldham and looking at pubs, and I've never been.
Right.
Never been to Oldham. And I went, oh, that's the difference then. A great artist, a great writer,
yes,
doesn't
yes
actually have to go.
That's true.
And he's just nailed it. Oh. But it just showed me that, yeah, do your research. But I was quite shocked that he'd never been to Oldham.
But do you think it's because Martin doesn't, I say it like he's my pal, isn't
no
it? But, because he doesn't condescend. Like, he's looking at finding an interesting story, whereas someone who is, I'm not saying that someone who's just a recent Oxford graduate is going to be writing a condescending Northern story, but was that the difference?
Yes and no. He doesn't condescend, and you're quite right, because you only have to look at all his work.
Well, all of his characters are bad. They've all got ugly inside of them.
I think they're all flawed.
Yes.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah, well, sorry, I say bad. I meant from...
No, I know what you mean, yeah.
They're, they've all got a darkness to them, and they're like a real authentic honesty, haven't they?
Yeah. But going back to what you said about darkness before, one of your baubles has just dropped off your tree. That might have been my fault. I'll put that on in a minute.
Don't worry.
We were talking about darkness before with Martin's work, and I think certainly from... not going back to the book, but there's some very dark humour in your book.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And it's people laugh at the darkness.
Well, some people laugh at the darkness. I think there's some people who would take that darkness very literally.
Well, as we've said before, people do take it a bit literally.
Do you think that Martin gets that with his work, or do you think because he's a man and he's been established for a long time that he gets that less so? Because I don't think anyone watches a Martin McDonagh play or film and then says, I feel really sorry for those characters.
Yeah, no, I don't think they do.
They go, well, that's dark. And
but also I think they're quite shocked.
Yes.
But I think he aims to shock.
Oh, yeah.
Definitely,
so good.
Whether that's on stage. And even when he wrote the Lenan trilogy before he got to the level that he is now,
He's always been unrelenting in that darkness, actually, even in his earlier work.
Oh, very much
That's his style, that's what he does, and you know what you're going to get.
I mean, I remember I saw a production of Beauty Queen of Lenan a fair few years ago now, and I went a few times to see it, and it was really, really interesting. I've just hit the mic, I'm professional. There was a group of 14, 15-year-old school kids in there from London at one point, and it was like a fucking rock concert. You've never heard anything like it. The shocks, the gasp, and even, don't do that! Like, they were saying...
Oh, really?
Person,
oh, I
no,
love
no,
that.
No, don't put... Oh, God, she's burning the letter. Don't burn the letter. Don't do that. Like, there was a commentary with it,
yeah,
but it didn't upset me.
No.
In fact, it really... It was just... encourage me to go to the theatre a bit more.
I wish that more shows were like that. If you go to any, a show by a black playwright or with an all-black cast, the audience will be, talking the whole way through in a really excited way and replying to... Because I spent a lot of time back at the Arts Centre. Replying to what's going on stage.
Yeah.
And I think that's exciting. But why should it be stuffy?
Exactly. I'm sick of stuffy theatre.
Yeah.
And I'm sick of quite boring, unsafe.
There's a lot of that, and TV as well, I think.
Oh, there's a lot. I'm going to go on to that. Yeah, definitely. Well, there is, yeah. But the door has to be open to be allowed to make risks and make change. But also, just going back to someone like Martin, it's like, well, he don't really give a fuck and he doesn't really like critics.
No.
And he's that's well documented. I'm not speaking out of class.
No. I'd like to meet him, actually, because his family are from the same part of Ireland as mine.
Oh, are they?
And it's a pretty inbred part of Ireland. It's in Galway. Lettermore is where my family are from.
Whereabouts is
Connemara?
That?
Connemara. So it's in the county of Galway, but it's in the middle of nowhere. And I've been looking into, family trees recently, and a lot of the Folans, so my family name is Folan, married McDonagh's. And I know that his family are from the same place. They came to Camberwell. And, what I'm saying is I'm definitely related
definitely.
To Martin McDonagh.
Wow. I can't believe that came up. That's brilliant.
Yeah, no, I mean, I don't know if I am, but I'd like to talk to him and see.
I mean, there's got to be
there must be a connection.
Some sort of connection.
Yeah.
I didn't know that at all.
No. It's not public knowledge. but it is now, yeah. So I'd be interested in talking to him to see if we have any relatives that we know.
I definitely think you'd get on.
Yeah, oh, I'd like to, you know, I'd like to think so, because I love his work. I mean, I really adore his work.
Yeah, he's as normal as they can be.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, well, that's good to know. Really? Yeah. Oh, I'm pleased to hear that. And, you know, yeah, I just admire him. I just think he's just brilliant.
So speaking of doors opening,
yes.
When did the door open for Rain Dogs?
Yes. So, God, we've gone around the houses of that one, haven't we?
Oh, we're going more. We're still on the same street at the moment.
So the book was dead because of this investigation.
Yeah.
But because with art, I think nothing ever dies. Like, there's always a chance for a piece of work that you've done ages ago, or, you know, to come back to life. It just happens to fall in the right hands. And this wasn't like a year-long process. This was relatively quick, but I was pretty depressed. I was like, the book's dead. It hasn't sold any copies. Everyone thinks it's a lie. My life's over. I'm never going to get a deal again. Billy Piper saved the day. Lovely Billy.
Mm.
She'd read early manuscript, and she is good friends with Piers Fenger, who was the head of BBC Drama at the time. And we met for a coffee. She said, I'd love to play you. And I'm like, well, yeah, obviously I'd love Billy Piper to play me. That would be amazing. Because you should always get someone better looking than yourself. To play you. And it's like, well, you know, Billy Piper, secret diver, cool girl, just like a national treasure.
Great actor. I mean, really brilliant actor.
What I love about her is that she has no vanity.
Yes.
And she's so beautiful. But
I was talking about that the other day. Right. The greatest ones have no vanity, and they're actually the most beautiful.
Yes. Yeah, well, yeah, the beauty becomes bigger, doesn't it?
Oh, huge. Yeah. Overwhelmingly so. Yeah.
I'm a big fan, really big fan of Billy.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah, she's just great. And so I was like, yeah, well, yeah, let's do it. And she's like, and obviously you'll write it. And I'm like, yeah, well, if they'll let me. She's like, no, you write it. And then so I met with Piers Fenger and we got on really well. And I'd had no interest from production companies. You know, every book bloody sells, doesn't it?
Yeah.
My book didn't sell.
Not at all.
Not at all. No interest. I'm wrong. One person sent a message saying that would I be interested in talking to them about the TV rights. But nothing really happened. Like, that happened when the proofs were going out.
Right.
You know, we were like 6 months on by
which
this
is
point.
Usually when all that sort of traffic happens, doesn't it?
I mean, I get sent ideas to turn into TV for books that are not even finished yet.
Wow.
So no one wanted Skin and Steak. And
I'm quite shocked by that. Even if it was somebody terrible who wanted to turn it into a...
I know. Yeah, not even anyone terrible.
No.
But then Piers said, here's six production companies I'd like to set you up having meetings with.
Yeah.
And, you know, you can choose who makes it. And then me and Billy had a bunch of meetings. You know, we started the process of making a TV show.
Which, you know, if people don't know, is a long and slow process.
Yes. Yeah,
these things do not happen in a few weeks or a few months.
No. We spent 2 years working on Skin and Steak, which actually, in terms of TV, isn't that long.
No. Sounds long for people who are listening who are not in this industry, but that's probably just the tip of the iceberg.
And I wrote the screenplay for two episodes, you know, as an adaptation of the book.
And we'll be looking at sort of hour-long episodes or...
No, it was half hours.
Half hours.
Yeah, it was always going to be a half-hour show. No, actually, I think when we first went in, me and Billy were like, three-hour long. So that's what we were sort of... Me and Billy were working together, 3 1-hour long episodes, but we sort of didn't know where it sat. Like,
what? As in, is it comedy drama?
Yeah,
are we going on the super heavy route?
Yes.
Yeah.
So, and then we were like, oh, maybe it could be slightly looser if it was half hour episodes. Anyway, we decided on Too Gentle. We started doing that for 2 years, and then I'd written two episodes, got paid for those. So I was quite happy because my life had changed. I'd sold the rights because I had these six companies. I didn't think Skin and Steak was ever going to be made, and I was right. Like, I took the highest bidder.
Right.
Because I thought, I'm sick of being poor. I'm going to buy a house.
Yeah.
And I took the highest bidder rather than thinking about what I actually wanted. Because I just didn't, you know, I think it's something like only 5% of books that get bought actually make it to TV. I think it's, I mean, it might even be less than that. I might be over-exaggerating. But so I was like, well, this isn't going to go to TV, so I'll take the money. And then, but was still hoping and was still trying to write a good script.
Yeah.
And then Billy got I Hate Susie, because her and Lucy Prebble have been working on that for a while. She dropped out. And I was like, I was unhappy. I was unhappy working on Skin to Stay. And I felt quite condescended to.
Right.
And I felt like it was a bit of a Liza Doolittle situation.
Yeah.
Well, we've got this poor girl who's written a book and we've given her a chance, a shot at life. It did feel like that.
Yeah, of course.
And I sort of took that opportunity to escape when Billy did. And
also take control.
Well, yeah, because
to a certain extent.
Yeah, I was a little bit scared because of the whole Guardian thing. And then I just thought, actually, my life's really nice now, because I do actually work in TV now. Like,
yeah.
You know, like, and although I haven't had, at that point, hadn't had anything on TV, I was like, well, I think I don't want this to be the first thing I put on TV. And I'd been having lots of meetings with other production companies and the HBO.
Yeah.
And I had said to them, I don't think this Skin to Stake thing's going to go. And they were like, what do you want to do? I said, well, I've got this idea, Rain Dogs. And BBC were a bit like, we've got this, you know, we think this sad show for drama, and now you're talking to HBO comedy. This isn't quite like melded up. HBO comedy and BBC drama, very different places. And I somehow managed to convince them. They said that if I got Daisy May Cooper, then they'd greenlight it. So they green light Rain Dogs. However, this is really messed up. The announcement came out as Skin to Stake.
I actually remember when that announcement came out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And they said Cash, it was supposed to come out as Cash Carraway Untitled Project. That's what it was supposed to be. And I wasn't going to say anything about the project, because Rain Dogs was only like an idea at this point. Well, I mean, it was more than an idea, but not enough to put out into the public. And I was just like, why? why are you saying it's Skin to Stake? And I sort of the show never recovered from that, because when Rain Dogs was announced as a separate show, journalists kept saying it's Skin to Stake. And the publicist on the HBO side is, or on the American side, is like, this is not Skin to Stake. But the publicist for Sid Gentle was saying that it was. And they had told the actors that they were making, they were filming an adaptation of Skin to Stake.
No.
Yeah, it was really strange. And I understand there might have been a little bit of confusion, because I jumped from one project to the next. But...
Well, it sounds like somebody sort of royally messed up there.
I think it's incompetence rather than malice. Yeah. And I think that when something that happens like that, and you're like, why is no one doing their job properly? I think it's because there's a lot of people in TV who are so comfortable in their position, because they got there because daddy created a TV show in the 60s or whatever, or they went to the right boarding school, and they just sort of sail on through, and they don't actually necessarily have a passion for creating something great.
Or an artistic bar in the body sometimes.
Well, there's that. And I don't think that's a bad thing, because I think there needs to be a balance between ideas people and money people, because, you know, money is not my strong point, but I could certainly come up with a good TV show.
No, but sometimes the ideas people shouldn't be in that job, because they don't think with creative thoughts like that.
Yes.
So therefore they should be on the other side.
Yes, yes, yeah.
But through one thing and another, they're there.
Yes, yeah. So, I mean, and I would like to say, like, Skin to Stake, most, for like half, 50% of the book, it's about a pregnant woman. Mm. And then it's like in a whirlwind of like early childhood and infanthood and madness. But never in Rain Dogs is there a pregnant mother
no.
working in a peep show. But people who hadn't read Skin Estate, journalists who hadn't read Skin Estate, just went with that. They were just like, oh, it's because it's about a single mum. It must be the same thing.
Oh, and so frustrating for you.
It was a bit frustrating, but also it's like, what can you do? You know, it's not a big deal at the end of the day. But what I found really frustrating was meeting the actors for the first time. And they're like, oh, I read your book. And I'm like, oh, God.
And they're like, a bit like when I came out of your house before.
Oh, you haven't read it, have you?
Oh, he's only got a fucking copy.
And they're like, what about this? And does this relate to this? Because it's not in the script, but is this? And I'm like, it's a completely different project. And they're like, what? Oh, I was told that it was Skin Estate, but you know, a few things have changed. So I was just like, so I was frustrated the whole time we're making Rain Dogs and the whole time doing publicity for it and the like year since.
Constant reconnection.
Constantly saying, by the way, it's because actually what's really terrifying is that Rain Dogs is about a woman who's sexually abused by her mum and doesn't know how to live because of it and all the subtle things. She doesn't really know how to go about her life. Like she takes her child, I'm not saying she's a bad mum, she takes her child to live in a stranger's house. She sleeps in a car. She sleeps in a laundrette. She does all of these things because she doesn't know how to behave because she's traumatised. Now, I wasn't sexually abused by my mum. My mum is an awful woman. She's a horrible woman. But in fairness to her, in all fairness, she's never, ever sexually abused me. And I kept saying that, like in interviews, I was like, you can't print that it's Skin Estate because it's about the sexually abused woman. And, you know, you can't say it's autobiographical, or no. Semi-autobiographical. And that's the thing that kept getting used. So they'd take out that it was Skin Estate and they'd put autobiographical. And it's like, that's even worse.
Yeah, yeah. But again, what we were talking about before about a certain person's angle. That seems like it's an angle.
Yeah,
to do
it is.
That. And because of your last project being Skin Estate and now this being.
And it's in the same wheelhouse. I get it. Like it's. There's similarities and crossovers. And, you know, the thing that got me is like, it's not a show about poverty. Like Skin Estate, there was a show about poverty.
Yeah.
And that's why I didn't want to make it because it's boring.
Yeah.
Rain Dogs.
And that's gone.
And that's gone. It's done. Yeah. It got rejected by me. It got rejected by Billy. The network said, don't do it. Like it was dead.
Yeah.
I forgot what I was going to say. What was
it? We were talking about the fact that...
Oh, if it's interesting, it will come back to me.
It will come back. But is it that's like I wasn't listening then, but I was just...
No, you were,
about,
you were.
I was just
were.
Thinking about that the men was gone, but that poverty side isn't the poverty
Sorry.
Show.
The story with Skin Estate, it's definitely clearly defined by poverty, whereas Rain Dogs, it's actually about a toxic family, a toxic relationship. And sure, it's set within the world of poverty, but... And she, this is, you know, there's a character in it that really struggles. But there's also... a character in it, probably the better written character, Selby, who doesn't struggle at all.
No.
You know, and to say it's a show about poverty while you've got that clear juxtaposition, I think it just feels, as you say, like an angle, and it feels dirty to me. Like it doesn't, it doesn't feel right. It just feels like a missell.
Yeah.
And I think that's why Rain Dogs did better in America than it did in England.
Well, I was going to talk to you about that. How did you feel about it being received in the States, or was that something you didn't think about? Did you think about how it would be received here and there, or you just didn't think about it? That wasn't part of your job.
Well, I told myself I wasn't going to read any reviews. Do you read reviews?
We all tell ourselves, Cash. Very rarely.
Oh, right, okay.
Very rarely. I don't, on the few occasions that I do theatre, I don't.
And that's scary with theatre, because obviously you have the opening night reviews and then you've got to do a run, right?
Well, yeah, because then... You know, I don't want to read something that would scupper a performance.
Exactly.
Whether that's, oh my God, what's going on? This is terrible. Or I love that. There's nothing worse. And this happens when filming as well. Nothing worse than someone coming up to you and you're not finished the scene yet. And they go, that little moment that you do there is amazing.
Oh, and then you play it up.
Or you just go, or you question what you were doing.
Yeah.
And you go, what was I doing? And subconsciously or actually consciously, you're trying to recreate what you've just been told is a little bit of, like, that's magical. That you don't know what it was because it happened in the moment. It was purely organic. And because you're not thinking about it too much, you're just listening and you're being in the moment, it will just take care of itself. If the homework's been done, it's fine. But the worst thing is for someone to say that. Yeah. So, no, I tend not to.
What about TV reviews? Because, I mean, that's done and dusted. There's nothing you can do. Or does it? Do you worry about sort of just feeling crap? You just don't want to do it?
No, I do. Yeah, I would read TV reviews, especially if it's something I really, really enjoyed and it really meant a lot to me.
Yeah.
Because 9 times out of 10, I'm working with a great ensemble and I want to know if the great time that we had translates. But I would never really get upset about it. If a television review was being particularly spiky.
Well, I'd said I wasn't going to read them.
But in the same sense, it's done.
There's nothing you can do.
You can't change it.
Exactly.
But maybe as a writer, you'd be able to learn more.
Well, the reason I wasn't going to read, and I read every one of them, by the way, but the reason I wasn't going to is because I didn't think my fragile ego could deal with it.
Right.
I was just thinking, if someone says the writing's bad, it's all like, that's like all I've got. if someone says I'm a bad writer, then I'm fucked. Luckily, they didn't. So it was not, and the reason that I read them, Charlie, who you met, who I'm writing some stuff with now, he was script editor.
Right.
On the Rain Dogs. And that to call him a script editor really does him a disservice because he was a story producer. Because I didn't have a writer's room on Rain Dogs.
Were you asked if you wanted one?
I mean, I asked for one about 50 times.
Oh, right. I thought you were going to say... Yeah, they kind of pushed it on me and I didn't really want to do that, but it was quite the opposite.
Oh, yeah, I wanted to write. So because I like to be the lead writer. I would have written all of the episodes.
Yeah.
But I wanted someone to say, yes, that is a good idea, Cash. You are very clever. Well done. Like, that's what I wanted in that situation. And, like, working in writers' rooms, I wouldn't expect that sort of pat on the back now. Like,
yeah, but
that's
it's not even just a pat on the back, is it? It's support.
It's support.
And you're in the process, which I think is really important.
And someone coming up with a better idea than you, which is always great.
But you're also building.
Yes.
You know, the foundations are laid and then someone's coming in and going, yeah, but what about that? And you go, great, well, I haven't thought about that. Because that's the same thing from my point of view as an actor. If I go into a scene having done my homework and I've got certain thoughts about how I feel my character needs to take this scene, and then it only takes what's going on with the other actor in the scene to turn it on its head. And then the layer again of a great director going, yeah, but what about if and you go, oh, that's amazing. Exactly. I hadn't thought of that. And it just changes it completely. So again, it's about support, albeit from different angles.
Yes. Yeah. I totally agree. But the thing with Rain Dogs is that because HBO needed to move quick and Daisy had she had a very tight schedule to film in, and then getting this like great cast in, and we had Daisy, Jack, Ron Kay, who I just adore, and then Adrian.
I mean, it was an exceptional cast.
It was unbelievable.
A lot of people I hadn't even seen before.
Right.
Jack especially, I didn't know where
I hadn't seen him.
Because he was incredible.
Well, he was like a lead in Poldark for years. I've never seen Poldark. I'd seen him in Spencer and I thought he was really great in that. I thought he was brilliant in that, actually. And I'd seen him in Lost Daughter, but he has a very small part in that.
Right.
And he does have a supporting role in Spencer as well. But what I knew from seeing those is that I wanted to see more of him. But, you know, they wanted to cast someone else. I had to fight for Jack. Like, I really, when I saw his tape, as I said, I hadn't really known much of his stuff, but I saw his audition tape and I was like, that's him. That's Selby. That's the guy. And BBC wanted to attach a very big name, which probably would have made it a bigger show, both because it's someone who's a household name in the UK and in the US.
Right.
So it would have made the show probably a lot more successful, but I don't think they would have been able to carry it in the same way.
But you had that power to stand up and fight.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
For a bit of casting.
Yeah.
You hear so many times where people go, well, yeah, you know. And I hear on the grapevine, well, I actually wanted so-and-so, but...
They
wouldn't allow it.
Yeah.
But nobody knows the character better than you.
Yeah, yeah.
Because it's a creation.
Yeah, exactly. Well, and you know, HBO were, like, really not on board with that. And but also, don't get me wrong, HBO also did get the final say. Like, they are the network, and I was working for the network.
But they also have a history of... creative freedom, you know.
They do trust
writers, as is evident from historic HBO. Whenever I see that it's a HBO show, or I hear there's trust there as an audience member. I think this is gonna.
It's premium.
Yeah. Yes. Whether it's drama, whether it's comedy, and it's going to push the boundaries because we know that the creators are being given that freedom as well as that support.
Yeah. No, they were great. The dream was always to work with HBO, and I thought that would be something that I'd get, like, later.
Down the line, yeah.
It's downhill from here.
No, it is. It's downhill. But isn't everybody's dream, you know?
Yeah, everyone
everybody's
wants to.
Dream.
Have you ever done a HBO show?
No. I'm UK.
Right. Yeah. Well, they do. I mean, they do quite a few.
Yeah. No. I know they do, but no, I haven't.
Well, it's still time.
But my friend, a few friends of mine has, and they've had lovely time working with them.
Yeah.
But talking about casting them for a second, and quite right that you fought for Jack because it was an incredible performance.
It was. He's just been nominated for Independent Film Spirit Award. You know, we were nominated for a Gotham Award.
Yes, I did read. Yeah,
a few weeks ago, and I went out there on my own, like a little Billy No Mates.
How was that?
It was interesting. It was I'd never done like a red carpet before, so that was really odd. But I was sat on the same table as the Safdie brothers.
Were you now?
Yeah, and I was shitting it. I was like because I was like, a big fan.
Yeah, of course,
huge fan. And I was there on my own, like no one else from the HBO, no one else from the production at all. So just me. And that's like weird, isn't it? Going to an awards ceremony on your own.
I think it's hard enough going to awards ceremonies full stop.
Yes.
Or industry. I find them a little bit easier now. But when I was starting out, like when I started out doing telly in like late 20s, I probably had a huge chip on my shoulder as well.
Right.
But I would probably become a little bit more northern.
Oh, right, yes.
Because
I was
quite clear that I shouldn't be here.
Yeah, I do that as well.
I will be a little
start
bit
start talking like that. Yeah, bit, lovely to meet you.
Yeah, but do you know what? It was just protection.
Yeah, of course.
So of course that's all it was.
Is it like a little bit of pride in who you are as well? It's like, I shouldn't be here.
But I am here.
Just so you know, I'm from the gutter. But I'm here with you people who had every opportunity. So, yeah, I think there's a bit of that. So, yeah, I was talking in a very Cockney accent walking around the Gotham Awards.
Strong penge.
It was
a premium penge.
It was premium penge. I don't think anyone could actually... I think I was speaking in such a strong penge accent that no one could actually understand what I was saying.
They just nodded and smiled.
Which is good. I was talking shit. But, you know, it was weird. And... to be on the table with like these people who are like, fucking hell, like because they'd been nominated for a show in the same category, but in the 40 minute, I was less than 40 minute because Rain Dogs is only like 25 minute episodes. But I was like, are these my peers? Like they are.
That is weird. Yeah.
Like I'm sat at a table with these people that I admire greatly, and we're in the same category, and we're both HBO shows, and that was a very strange moment.
Like literally in the room.
You're in the room. Yeah, and then there's like De Niro over to that side, and there's like Greta Gerwig over there, and literally everyone in Hollywood just like mingling.
Wow.
But I was completely shy, and you know, there were so many people. I was like, right, I'm going to go talk to that person. And then in the end, I was just like, you know, I'm just going to go home.
No, let's not spoil the night.
Yeah, exactly.
I'd be too nervous.
Exactly. Yeah, so just went home. But I can't remember what we were talking about.
I was asking about casting, which was
yes.
brilliant.
Yeah.
Jack
was
the fact that amazing. You fought for him. But on the other, the flip side of the coin, the deal was that you had to have Daisy May Cooper as your lead.
Yes.
Now, had you thought about a person for that lead. Because it's, if you'd have been, and she did a brilliant job.
Yeah, she did a great job. Brilliant,
because I think she's such a brilliant comedic actress as she is.
Mm.
I think she's got real heart and depth of an actor, full stop. I don't really like comedy actors, dramatic actors. Like, you're an actor, full stop. And if you can nail comedy, you're going to be all right with drama. That's just what I think, because I think comedy is really, really difficult to get right.
When I was writing her, I thought of, what's her name?
Oh, you don't have to say.
She's great. I'm saying it in a good way. Hayley, my mind's gone blank. Daniel Blake. She was in
Hayley Squires.
Hayley Squires, yes.
She's been on this very podcast.
Oh, yes. I've listened to it. She's brilliant.
She's incredible.
Yeah, I think she's great. And I wanted I'd written Costello as someone quite glamorous, actually. And more free. Like, I think Daisy played it brilliantly. But it wasn't what I expected.
Yeah.
But I think that's really interesting.
Well, isn't that quite exciting for a writer?
Oh, totally. Yeah? It's like when you hear that Jimmy McGovern story about when he cast Robbie Coltrane in Cracker.
Yeah.
And he'd wanted a bald, thin man. It's like, but could you see Cracker without Robbie Coltrane? Like, I don't know who that actor was that he was picturing. As he was doing it, Daisy was perfect.
Yeah.
Because Costello worked so well. And there'd been no chemistry reads or anything. Like,
sometimes you just don't need it.
We're very lucky. But because they were so good, I think. Because all of the actors are of a very strong calibre. Like, they became this family. They became this weird family.
Now, you talked about standing up there for Jack, because as soon as you saw that audition, that tape, whatever, you saw Selby and he was their flesh.
Yeah.
How would it have been for you if you'd have been pushed on for someone to play Costello, who said, this is who we need, and you've got a green light, and you just went, I can't fight for this, I don't agree with it?
I would have stood up and said what I...
Oh, would you?
What I wanted, yeah. I mean, it doesn't mean I would have got it, right?
No.
But, yeah, I mean, I think you should always fight for your show. You should always... If you've taken the time to create something, and also, I think, like, a lot of networks will listen. Unless you're creating a vehicle for someone, there's not generally...
Especially if there's a reason. You've got to speak and you've got to have a reason. If you're going to war, make sure you've got all your tools, you know, to back up, fight.
Do you know what? Rain Dogs was a war. That making Rain Dogs was a complete war. It was very fraught. And I think that's why the show is so insane. So I think it worked. It worked to my advantage, because having to constantly... speak up and say, I'm not happy with that. And I remember one day getting the rushes through and being like, no, this is not the show. This is absolutely not the show. And then we did like reshoots and stuff. So I think actually, like, if you're a creator and you're speaking out, I think it shows that you know the show well. Like, you're not being an arsehole. And I think there are people that will go, oh, well, she's a bit up herself. Like, why, who's she to?
Or she's tricky, which I hate. I hate the word, I hate it so much.
Yeah.
Because I'm constantly, I tell sort of younger actors who ever sort of message me or I talk to them at drama school, I said, always ask questions.
Yeah.
Always. And not just about, what are they doing? Know the crew and all that. But always ask questions.
Yeah, you should.
About the script.
Yeah, totally. Writers love that. It's the best thing to be. Yeah.
Writers love it. Sometimes other people don't like it, because it's like sometimes the writer isn't there all the time.
So producers don't like it?
I think sometimes producers don't like it, because they just want to get on with it.
Yeah.
Sometimes. Not that they don't care, but I would hate anybody to be perceived at an... It sticks in my throat, as to be tricky.
Have you ever been?
Yes, I believe so.
Well, that's good, I think.
But I think sometimes I went around about things in a bit of a bull in a china shop way.
There's a real difference to...
But I think that's part of... I think I was just immature.
Immature. But isn't there a difference between being rude and actually being firm in your ideas?
Yes, absolutely. And I think if you're raising a question, you have to raise it for a reason, which is why I was saying you have to back it up. But sometimes you don't need to back down.
No.
You can't back down.
No. I mean, like, as long as everyone around you can see you're not being an asshole, you want to get it right.
But you would hate to be perceived as an asshole, or someone that was trying to be tricky, for your own sake.
But I think that depends on who's doing the perceiving. Like, if it's someone I respect doing the perceiving, then that's a concern.
Yeah.
But if it's someone who I think, if I'm fighting an idea that I don't think is very good, then their perception of me is wrong.
Yeah. No, I completely agree.
Like there's a lot of expectation that, especially working class women, I think, to be polite. And, you know, I shouldn't be grateful to be doing this job. I'm actually good at it. And that's not arrogant to say it. I know I can do it because the product is there. I can do it. So it's other people's prejudice that's sort of getting in the way. Like, that's not none of my business. If they're prejudiced and they think I'm tricky, then fine. But do you get a good show? Yes. So what's the problem?
I was so silent there because I was really listening, because it's so fantastic to hear you say that, but to hear people say that.
Yeah.
Because you have to care and you have to know your worth.
Yes, yeah.
And go, well, I know what I'm doing and I really care about it.
Yeah.
And look, the product, the end product will be very, very good.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think what we were saying earlier about there being a lot of people in TV who don't actually care, and they're just about competent, or if that. Mm. And they're in it for the going to the BAFTAs once a year. They want to wear a fancy dress.
Yeah.
You know, they don't actually care about being good. And I want to be good. I'd rather not go to any awards. I'd rather not get nominated for any awards. And then just be like a group of people say, that's good. And I really enjoy that.
Yeah, I mean, it'd be quite nice not to go to awards. But sadly, you've been nominated for a BAFTA breakthrough.
Oh, yeah, that's nice. That is nice.
Which is incredible. And that's one of the reasons when I was thinking about you and you agreed to do this. And I was re-listening to Skin to Stay. And then I was doing a bit more reading. And I went, we're not going to talk about this. This isn't what it's all about.
Oh, good.
What it's all about is leading up to this, which is this incredible nomination, because people will look at it and go, oh, wait a minute, that's just on the success of Rain Dogs. But it's 20 years of leading up to this.
Yeah, that's annoying, actually. And I think that happens to all artists, isn't it? It's like everyone just thinks you've appeared out of nowhere, because it does look like that. It's like, oh, this person's suddenly there. But they don't see all the failures along the way, all the humiliation. And I think
and the rejection.
Oh, all of, yeah. And that's awful. And then so you get this one little moment and people are like, who are they? Look, it's done one thing. Who cares?
But again, that's their
prejudices. Yes.
No,
exactly.
And you know what? There's nothing you can do about that.
There's nothing you could do. No. And the people who've like had BAFTA breakthrough before, like you look through it and you're like, my God.
Yeah.
These people are great.
Yeah.
Like, and even the people that are, like, this year, like Charlotte Regan. I mean, have you seen Scrapper?
Yeah, I love Scrapper.
Yeah, I mean, I think she's great. And also, actually, the first things I ever saw her do were the Neil Maskell shorts.
Yeah,
because
yeah.
I made a film with...
A short with Neil.
Yeah, which got banned.
Well, yeah, I know. I was... sadly, I can't see that. But...
I'll send you.
Oh, really? Oh, I can't see it.
Yeah.
Yeah, because I was supposed to have Charlotte on here.
Oh, really?
And we just couldn't make dates. She was Scrapper.
She's too popular.
Scrapper had been released and we had a tiny, tiny window between my film and then she was about to go into pre-production. We just couldn't do it.
What a shame.
But, you know, you can't chat to everybody.
No, I would have loved to have heard that.
Yeah, I know, me too.
Yeah, she's very special. And people like Bella Ramsey, and they're just like great people just on this list. And, you know, people that have been on there before, like, oh my God. How did that happen? So it's,
well, you know how it happened. Hard work.
Yeah, it's hard work. But lots of people work very hard and don't get that.
That's
true. So it's nice. But it's not the reason to create. Like, it's nice to get, like, acknowledgements along the way. It makes you feel proud for a moment. But actually, the purpose of it isn't for that.
No, but it is. It is going to help.
Yes.
I mean, get to keep getting up.
Yes.
The rungs of the ladder, so to speak. It is going to help it, and it's going to get your work seen by other people.
Yeah, and what's actually really interesting is, like, with BAFTA is the whole breakthrough thing is I didn't grow up knowing anyone in TV. I didn't grow up knowing anyone in publishing or any kind of media. Like, that's just not the world that I was from. And to actually have access to people to contacts and networking. That's, I mean, because that's what BAFTA is, isn't it? It's about connecting an industry together. So, I mean, how brilliant is that to be part of something, to not be like, oh, I don't know who to give this script to, and I don't know who to, you know, because that was why it took so long to get to doing Rain Dogs, because I'd be sending out stuff blindly. You know, I didn't know anyone. So, it's great. BAFTA Breakthrough is very cool.
It's the only time during this that you've slightly clammed
up. Yeah, I just realised. I've got like,
But I want to say massive congratulations.
Oh, thank you.
When I saw your name and Charlotte's name, actually, I was really chuffed, and I don't know either of you, and I just thought, you know, you're making work that sort of speaks to me, and I think it's really important that it's an open shop. And,
yes.
And it kind of should be an open playing field.
Yeah.
And, you know, cliche, but, you know, the cream rises to the top, doesn't it? So that's really good news.
Yeah, it just takes a little bit longer, I think.
Yeah, it does.
I wish I'd had some kind of success when I was, like, younger and more attractive. I feel like I could have, like, really, like, gone for it a lot more. But I feel like a middle-aged woman, it's like, oh, damn, I passed my prime. Do you know what I mean? Not in terms of work. Just like, I just feel like I've lost some of the enjoyment. Because when you get to like 43, you're somewhat sort of jaded about the world, and you sort of know how things work, and you know how.
Yeah, but, you know, with more knowledge, maybe more power.
Yeah, I mean, of course.
I'm pleased that I didn't have like success in my 20s.
Right.
Because I wouldn't have been mature enough
to handle it. Right.
Well, I would have probably said the wrong thing. Not that I was a selfish little prick, because I wasn't, but maybe I was still, we talked about, you know, being a bit chippy before. Right. Maybe I would have been a little bit more gobby.
Yeah.
And probably upset a few more people, and that's not
good. How old were you when you got successful?
Well, I mean, I don't really know what that means, successful, but I suppose once I started being on the telly a bit more.
Yeah.
No, I don't know. I think I like to feel with the mistakes that I've made in the past, I'm in a good place to receive what's coming now. Do you know, does that make sense?
Yeah,
also. So I don't think, I wouldn't think, oh God, I'd love to go back to that time, but still have quote-unquote success now.
Yeah, yeah.
I feel it's in a nice place, and I think that's what I think.
You're comfortable with your position.
Yeah, I'm comfortable with that, but I think that's where, I'm not telling you what to do, but I think that's where you should be now, because I think it's fantastic that it's happened now.
Yeah, well, I mean, everything happens when it's supposed to happen, right?
Yeah.
I guess. So, I'm very happy. I have a very nice life, and I get to write and create stuff. So, yeah, what more could I ask for, really?
Cass Carroll, thank you so much.
This has been brilliant.
It's
been lovely. Thank you for having me.
So, so welcome.
And another episode is done. The penultimate episode is done. I'm so pleased you enjoyed it. It was a really, really good meeting. A really good first meeting. Again, with Joe Wilkinson, it's like, yeah, this is why I started it, to have these type of conversations that we just don't have and you don't read about, and it's not guests that you have on everybody else's podcast. We work really, really hard to get the guests that other people don't have. So you have conversations and you're hearing again and again and again. Okay. Well, look, have a lovely, lovely Christmas. I know sometimes Christmas can feel stressful, lonely, a bit sad. I hope it isn't for you this year. I hope we can, you know, pull together and try and have a nice, peaceful time. But you're thinking now, Craig, there's one more episode, the final episode, the 1st of January. New Year's Day, new beginnings, new starts, the end of the Two Shot Podcast. I'll meet you back here, 1st of January, and I'm going to be recording from the beach on New Year's Day. So look, do what you need to do to enjoy or survive Christmas. And I'll see you on New Year's Day. Okay? Lots and lots of love. Until then, I've been Craig Parkinson. He's been producer Griff. And this has been the penultimate Two Shot podcast. I'll see you on the 1st of Jan, 24.
The Two Shot podcast was presented by me, Craig Parkinson. Recorded and produced by Thomas Griffin for Splicing Block. The remix of our theme tune is by Stolen Valor. Cheers.